whiskey, gents? Victor and Ron both agree that's exactly what the doctor ordered. Jack Mason pours the drinks and settles back again. You're missing someone, says Jack. Someone else involved in my little scheme.
Man or woman? Asks Victor very casually.
One of those, yeah, says Jack Mason. If you want someone to resist questioning from a KGB officer, a Cockney isn't a bad choice, Ron thinks.
So, this person, begins Ron, probably a fella, let's face it, they've killed Bethany Waits.
Here's what it is, says Jack Mason. The scheme was coming apart. Bethany Waits was all over it. You've got to know when to quit, right?
Crucial, says Victor.
I figure I'm covered. Whatever she's got, she hasn't got on me, so I can just shut it down and move on.
But this partner of yours?
My partner was more worried, says Jack Mason. Left me in no doubt about that. I hadn't made any big mistakes, but my partner had. He, I am going to say he, but don't read anything into it. I've been in this game a long time. He was worried about me talking, about Heather talking.
You'd never talk, says Ron.
Never have, never will, agrees Jack.
You're talking now, Jack, says Victor, very gently. Jack waves us away. So, says Ron, this partner of yours kills Bethany Waits.
Before she caused more trouble, says Jack. Killed her. Drove to Shakespeare Cliff, pushed the car off. My partner wasn't the type at all, but he panicked. Happens to the best of us.
But why wasn't the body in the car? Asked Victor. I wonder if you have an explanation for that.
Here's the thing, says Jack Mason. Here's the big problem, the thing no one's seeing. My partner comes to me, tells me he's murdered Bethany Waits, tells me to switch on the news and see if it's true, which I do, and it is. I'm not happy.
Who would be? Says Ron.
Who would be, like you say, agrees Jack. I'm angry, of course, I am. Fry off the handle a bit. No one needed to die. We could have walked away. And he gives me a little smile and says, no one's walking away. And I think he's going to kill me too, which is a bit rich, but these things happen.
Ron and Victor both nod.
Then, he says, you want to see the body? And I'm... Wasn't the body in the car? And he's, no, the body's buried somewhere safe. Jesus, says Ron.
The whiskey's giving him a bit of a headache. The lights blinking out at sea now look cold and lonely.
And here's what he's done, says Jack. He's killed Bethany, and he's buried her, and he's told me exactly where. And here's the clever bit. I'll give him that. He's buried Bethany with a phone covered in Heather Garbutt's fingerprints, which has a call history from one of my personal phones. And he shot her with a gun that's buried somewhere else, also covered in Heather's fingerprints.
Victor sits forward. So Bethany is dead. She can meddle no longer. And your partner has framed Heather for the murder and linked you as an accessory.
You're getting it, says Jack Mason. He says to Heather, this fraud is going to trial. I need you to plead guilty, to admit everything but not a word on who you were working for.
Or I send the police in the direction of Bethany's grave,
where all the evidence says Heather did it. So do you want 10 years in prison or do you want life? It's blackmail, buried 6 feet underground.
And that's been hanging over her the whole time she's been in prison? Asks Ron.
She never said a word, and she never made a penny, says Jack Mason. She just sat and did her time, knowing that one false move, and she'd be a murderer.
All that waiting, says Ron.
Then someone kills her too. That's what you call it, bad luck.
The men nod, like the three wise monkeys. And what Did he want from you? Asked Victor.
He wanted his money, says Jack Mason. It was 10 mil or so, and he couldn't access it.
And you could?
Turns out no, says Jack Mason. The rules changed back in 2015. Everything had to be declared, hoops to jump through, and then other obstacles kept popping up. Never really seen anything like it. Do you know much about money laundering?
Yes, says Victor.
We washed it so thoroughly, it was scattered to the winds. Heather was very good at her job, but when we needed it to start coming back the other way as clean money, some of the things we needed to do to get it back were no longer legal, and some of the money had just vanished. We hid it so well, even we couldn't find it.
So it's still out there? Asked Victor.
Presumably, says Jack Mason.
Any chance you're going to tell us who your partner was? Asked Ron.
Course not, says Jack Mason. I shouldn't have told you as much as I have. But if you can work it out, good luck to you.
We'll work it out, says Ron. He can hear the car approaching in the distance.
She shouldn't have died, says Jack Mason. It's on me. And Heather shouldn't have died either. That's on me too.
I'd like to disagree, Jack, says Ron, but I can't. Jack nods and looks around him, at his house, his gardens, that view.
There was no need for any of it.
The headlights of Ron's Daihatsu sweep across the lawn. Bogdan is here. Jack rises to wish his friends farewell, but Victor has a final question. Why did you not just dig the body up yourself? Problem solved.
I tried to find it, says Jack Mason, over the years. Believe me, I tried. I knew where it was, and I've dug and dug, but...
Will you tell us where she's buried? Victor asks.
I've told you enough to be getting on with, says Jack. You buggers can work it out.
Your candor has been admirable, says Victor. Jack puts an arm around Victor's shoulders.
I can't help thinking these revelations have taken the edge off your snooker victory this evening, and Ron's shocking performance.
Will we still be invited back? Asks Victor.
I can't think of anything more fun, says Jack Mason. A couple of mates, a glass of whiskey, a game of snooker. Everything else is ego and greed. It's taken me a long time to work that out.
You still owe Victor a tenner for winning, though, says Ron.
Among my many debts, says Jack Mason with a bow. Among my many debts.
Chapter 55. Elizabeth is wide awake and thinking. Victor had rolled back late this evening full of news and whiskey. Ron was elsewhere, which is becoming an increasingly regular occurrence. A quick council of war had convened at Ibrahim's. Joyce and Alan had joined them, both excited to be out late. The case had blown wide open. So, Bethany Waits hadn't been in the car at all. She had been buried somewhere else by her killer as an insurance policy, buried with evidence linking both Heather Garbutt and Jack Mason to her murder. It was a neat trick. No one was looking for the body. It was assumed that it had been swept out to sea many years ago. But if Jack or Heather ever felt inclined to help the police with their inquiries, the killer would just have to remind them that their future was in his hands. Or her hands. Keep quiet about my involvement or face the consequences. But there would be a flaw somewhere, a fatal mistake. As Elizabeth had walked home, she had felt a plan forming. Her eyes had also been alert for the Viking. It would be rather bad timing to be killed now, just when things were getting interesting. They would get nothing further out of Jack Mason, Elizabeth was sure of that. Victor's work with Jack was done. So there were two options left open. Take another look at the financial documents, knowing there was a partner involved. They had the name Karen Whitehead, of course, but nothing else to connect her to the murder. Then there was the name Robert Brown, MSc. But were there others? Victor will be back on the case tomorrow morning. He has yet to make much progress. The second option, just as difficult, but at least something Elizabeth could help with, was to find the grave that Jack Mason has spoken about. The general consensus is that it could be anywhere, but Elizabeth rarely lives her life by the general consensus. A question that had been troubling her for a while has risen to the surface again. Why had Jack Mason bought Heather Garbutt's house? The proceeds had gone straight to the government in lieu of the laundered money, so he hadn't been buying Heather's silence. He hadn't lived in it, hadn't rented it out, hadn't renovated it, and hadn't sold it at a profit. So it seemed that Jack Mason must have bought the house simply to stop anyone else from living there. From living there and, let's say, relaying the patio or deciding on a whim to dig a pond or two. Elizabeth wonders if it wouldn't be fruitful to have a little dig in Heather Garbutt's garden. Bogdan will have a spade to hand somewhere. But how do you just dig up someone's garden without permission? Jack Mason certainly won't be inviting them onto the property if the body is there. As Elizabeth lies in bed, Stephen's hand interlaced with hers, she thinks of someone who might be able to help. And now she really thinks about it, the same person might be able to help her with her other problem too, stopping the Viking. Stephen wakes and takes her in his arms. He says he is off to see his friend Kuldesh tomorrow, would probably take the car if she isn't using it. Elizabeth agrees, that sounds lovely, and strokes his hair until he falls asleep again.
Chapter 56. They must have gossiped on the way back, Donna says. Her head is in Bogdan's lap. He wants to watch the international biathlon on Eurosport because someone he went to school with is in it. Biathlon is skiing followed by rifle shooting. She is getting into it.
They swore me not to tell, says Bogdan.
Then he gestures at the television.
Yashe is having a nightmare here.
But you can tell me, says Donna.
No police, says Bogdan.
I'm not police, says Donna. I'm your girlfriend.
You never said you were my girlfriend before, says Bogdan.
Donna turns her head to look up at him. Well, get ready to hear it a lot.
So, I am your boyfriend.
I honestly don't know why people think you're some sort of genius, says Donna. Yes, you're my boyfriend. Bogdan gives a smile of delight.
We are Donna and Bogdan.
We are, says Donna, reaching up to touch his face. Or Bogdan and Donna, I don't mind.
Donna and Bogdan sounds better, says Bogdan.
Donna props herself up and kisses him. Donna and Bogdan, it is then. So tell me what Ron and Victor found out.
No, says Bogdan.
He is then distracted by the television again.
This Lithuanian guy is a cheat.
Just tell me something, says Donna. Throw me a bone.
Okay, says Bogdan. Ron didn't go home tonight. He is staying at Pauline's.
Ew, says Donna. That's good. You're forgiven.
Bogdan is shaking his head at the screen. If Yashe doesn't finish in the top four, he doesn't qualify for the European shootout at Malmo.
Poor Yashe, says Donna. Pull your finger out, mate. Where does she live, huh? Bogdan is distracted. Pauline, says Donna sleepily. She live around here? Bogdan nods.
Off Rotherfield Road, that big block, Juniper Court.
Juniper Court?
Yes, you heard of it?
Donna certainly has heard of it. Pauline lives in the building Bethany Waits visited on the night of her murder. Chapter 57. The office is warm oak and deep red carpet. Elizabeth's eye is drawn to the large painting of a dog wearing a police bravery medal, also a framed sign saying, "Crime doesn't pay." She has learned over the years that this is nonsense. Look at Victor's penthouse, for example. It can be difficult to get an appointment with a chief constable. They are busy people. Their diaries are carefully controlled. Try ringing 999 and asking to speak to a chief constable. See where that gets you. Elizabeth had rung Andrew Everton's office that morning, saying she was a literary agent who had read and loved all the Mackenzie McStuart novels, and would he have a moment to spare for her? The call came back within a minute, saying that a window had magically opened up in his diary that very afternoon. Whatever it was that Andrew Everton had planned on doing then, catching a serial killer perhaps, could be put on the back burner. Elizabeth had seen the disappointment in his eyes when she walked in. He recognised her from the reading. There was a brief moment of regrouping, hope, as he considered that, yes, this was the old woman from the reading the other day, but she might also actually be an agent, some grand dame of the literary world. But as soon as she said, "I haven't actually read your books, though I know Joyce is enjoying one," she saw the wind depart his sails. By this point, she had sat down, however, and she knew that common politeness would allow her a couple of questions. "Bethany Waits," says Elizabeth. "You remember the case?"
"I remember the case," says Andrew Everton. "I don't remember asking you to come in and talk to me about it."
Elizabeth waves this away. "We're all taxpayers, aren't we? Anything you can tell me? Any suspects at the time?" "Says Andrew Everton.
"Are you familiar with police procedure?"
"Very," says Elizabeth. Andrew Everton starts to tap a pen on his desk.
"And does this conversation feel like it tallies with police procedure, given what you know?"
"Here's what I think," says Elizabeth. "I think you're the Chief Constable of Kent. I think you could probably tell me all sorts of things if you chose to. I also think you failed to close the Bethany Waits case."
"Not me, personally," says Andrew Everton. "To be fair, I was a smaller cog in those days."
"Quite so," agrees Elizabeth. "But a high-profile case still unsolved, I'm offering you some help, and it feels only fair that you offer me help in return."
"What help are you offering me?"
"We'll get to that in good time," says Elizabeth. "You know that Heather Garbutt is dead."
"Was she your prime suspect?"
"She was a suspect," says Andrew Everton.
"Again, what help can you give me? What do you know that I might not?"
"And Jack Mason?" asks Elizabeth. "Another suspect?"
"We spoke to him," says Andrew Everton. "He had an alibi, but he's not the type of man to do the deed himself, so it was fairly meaningless. I don't quite understand. Why are we having this conversation?"
"Anyone else?" asks Elizabeth. "Anyone we're missing?"
"Who is we?"
"My friends and I," says Elizabeth. "People you would like. I believe you've met Ibrahim, for instance."
"Ah, yes," says Andrew Everton. "Ibrahim Arif, a friend of Connie Johnson."
"A professional acquaintance of hers," says Elizabeth. "We have fingers in pies, Chief Constable. I'm sure you would find us useful."
Andrew Everton is weighing her up. Elizabeth has seen it countless times before, people trying to get the measure of her. It's a fruitless endeavour. "Okay," says Andrew Everton. "I'll bite. Does Connie Johnson have anything to say about Heather Garbutt's death? Is that information that you have?"
"She thinks Heather Garbutt was frightened of someone," says Elizabeth.
"Well, with respect, we could gather that much from the note. That's not new information," says Andrew Everton. "I'll need better than that. Did she say who?"
"I'm afraid that is information I don't have, but you'll be delighted to hear I can help you with the note," says Elizabeth. "It wasn't real."
"Wasn't real?"
Elizabeth sees Andrew Everton think this through, working the angles. Experience tells her he is no fool. He might actually be useful to them. She didn't write it. Andrew Everton still looks confused.
Then who did?
We're working on that, says Elizabeth. But until then, I have a different question for you. Where do you think the money is? If we can't find Bethany Waits's body, can we at least find the money?
You're aware we did try, says Andrew Everton. We're not bumpkins. We had forensic accountants go through every page of every file. They covered their tracks.
Elizabeth laughs. Honestly, we found out more about the money in 2 weeks than you did in your whole investigation.
I doubt that, says Andrew Everton.
Doubt away, dear, says Elizabeth. It won't change the facts. You didn't find the £40,000 paid to Karen Whitehead. You didn't find the £5,000 paid to Robert Brown, MSE. You didn't find the connection to Jack Mason's construction companies. You didn't really find anything.
Andrew Everton tries to form a reply. I'm going to need those names, the details, where you found them.
There's the answer to your question about how we can help you. And, Elizabeth takes out a file from her bag and puts it on his desk, we can start with this.
Andrew Everton looks at the file in front of him. It's all in here?
It is, says Elizabeth, and it's all yours, but I will need a couple of favours in return.
Yes, you have that air about you, says Andrew Everton. If I can help, I will.
Jack Mason bought Heather Garbutt's house, says Elizabeth. Over the odds, too. Why do you think that might be?
Andrew Everton has no answer. Honestly? I wasn't aware of that.
Perhaps you should have been.
Perhaps I should, says Andrew Everton.
Agreed. Now that you know, says Elizabeth, what do your detective instincts tell you?
That perhaps he was hiding something there, or knew that Heather was hiding something there.
That's what my instincts tell me too, says Elizabeth. It feels like it wouldn't do us any harm to go digging to see. If you could arrange that?
Andrew Everton thinks for a moment. Elizabeth suspects there are all sorts of forms he would need to fill in to make this happen. Protocols. I think I could, says Andrew Everton. I think that sounds a very good idea.
See what we can see. See what we can see, agrees Elizabeth. I knew we'd get along.
What was the other favour? Asks Andrew Everton.
There's a money launderer trying to kill me, says Elizabeth. Trying to kill Joyce too, but that's between us. I wonder if you might spare a couple of officers to guard us for a while.
A money launderer, says Andrew Everton.
Best in the world, they say. Let's hope he's not such a good assassin.
Let me look into it, says Andrew Everton. That might be quite hard to explain away.
I'm sure you'll try your best, says Elizabeth, and you might just catch the biggest money launderer in the world in the process. That feels like something that would be good for your career.
Andrew Everton smiles. This has been an unexpected pleasure.
Well, strap in, says Elizabeth. Next time I see you, I expect you to have a spade in your hand.
Elizabeth stands to leave. This has all been most satisfactory. If anyone can get permission to dig up a back garden, it's a chief constable.
Andrew Everton rises with her.
Before you go, says Andrew Everton, I have a question for you.
People usually do, says Elizabeth. She senses Andrew Everton is nervous.
Fire away. I need an honest answer, says Andrew Everton.
If an honest answer is available, you shall have it, says Elizabeth.
Your friend Joyce, says Andrew Everton.
What about her, says Elizabeth?
Did she really say she was enjoying my book?
Chapter 58. Donna has very quickly come to understand that one of the key functions of a television makeup room is to be a central hub for all and any gossip. Though on this occasion, she's going to have to tread carefully. Donna is back on Southeast Tonight to discuss online fraud, dodgy emails or texts pretending to be from banks, fake dating profiles, basically any of the number of ways someone can part you from your cash without ever having to actually meet you. She has been doing homework all afternoon. "A little bird tells me you live in Juniper Court," says Donna. Pauline pauses for a moment. Donna has to keep this as light as possible. They had run all the car registration numbers. The white Peugeot with flames on the number plate belongs to Pauline. Pauline continues teasing Donna's hair into shape. "That little bird wouldn't be Bogdan, would it?" "Maybe," says Donna. "We've been trying to keep it quiet." "Can't hide anything from a makeup artist," says Pauline. "You landed on your feet there. What a fella. I'd climb him like a tree." Donna smiles and keeps it chatty. "You been there long?" "Juniper Court? Donkey's years," says Pauline. "You can walk to the studio. It's perfect." So there it is, the information she was here to get. Pauline has lived at Juniper Court for years, which means she will have been living there the night Bethany died, which in turn potentially makes her the chief suspect in the murder of Bethany Waits. Things are moving uncomfortably fast for Donna. Pauline taps Donna's forehead. "Relax, you're frowning. The makeup chair isn't for thinking." "Sorry," says Donna. She takes the briefest of glances at Pauline in the mirror. Pauline gives her a reassuring smile. What reason would Pauline have for murdering Bethany Waits? What was buried in the past? What about the notes? Had Pauline written them? Chris and Donna are keeping this new line of inquiry secret from the Thursday Murder Club for a number of obvious reasons, but if Bethany had been visiting Pauline that night, they wouldn't be able to keep it secret for much longer. It was too much of a coincidence, Bethany visiting the building where Pauline lived. There had to be a connection. "That's why I moved to Juniper Court in the first place," says Pauline over the sound of her hairdryer now. "Loads of the crew live there. Cameras, sound, all sorts. The show even keeps a couple of flats there. You know, freelancers come down for a few months. That's where they get put up. Mike had a place there years back. It's like a hall of residence half the time." Donna nods. Well, that complicates things if it's true. All sorts of people Bethany might have known. All sorts of people she might have been visiting. Donna needs more information. "Bethany ever visit?" Donna asks, trying to be casual, but over the sound of the hairdryer. "How do you mean? Would Bethany have ever visited Juniper Court?" "I'd have thought so," says Pauline. "People were in and out. Fiona Clements had a thing with one of the camera ops who lived there. It was open house." "Did she ever visit you there?" Donna asks. "Me? No," says Pauline. She switches off her hairdryer. "Don't think she even knew I lived there." "You think she would have bumped into you," says Donna, "at some point, if she was there a lot?" "I'm a bit more private than some of them," says Pauline, shrugging. Donna had plenty to report back to Chris. The good news, Pauline had lived in Juniper Court when Bethany Waits disappeared. The bad news, so had everyone else. Convenient for Pauline. Too convenient? "That's you done, darling," says Pauline. "Don't you look a picture." Donna looks at herself in the mirror. Just perfect. Pauline is very, very good. Chapter 59. He thought he might have to kill the dog, but in the end there was no need. From the moment he broke in, the dog seemed very happy to see him. Had even licked his hand while he loaded the gun. He had been fast asleep until the key turned in the lock for the first time. The Viking would love a dog, but they take a lot of looking after.
walking and so on. And sometimes things go wrong with them. What if something went wrong and he didn't notice? The Viking would never forgive himself. He has heard that cats are easier. Maybe he will get a cat. The first person through the door is Joyce. He recognizes her from the photograph. Joyce has a shopping bag in her hand. She is swaying slightly and is whistling a happy tune. She stops whistling when she sees the gun, which makes the Viking feel guilty but powerful. Mainly guilty, but he couldn't deny the powerful bit. He supposes that is why weak people like guns so much. Not that he is weak. The dog bounds to greet her, and Joyce ruffles his coat without taking her eyes off the man with the beard and the gun who has just appeared in her living room. "Bless you," says Joyce. "You must be the Viking." The Viking is confused.
"The Viking?"
"You kidnapped Elizabeth," says Joyce, "and Stephen. Which was very cowardly. Put your gun down. I'm 77. What do you think I'm going to do?" The Viking puts the gun down by his side, but keeps hold of it. It is around 7 p.m. and dark outside. He has closed the curtains already. Joyce is less scared than he thought she might be. She even feeds the dog. "Alan," he is called. She offers the Viking a cup of tea, but wary of being poisoned, he declines. She sits opposite him while Alan eats his metal bowl, scraping noisily on the kitchen tiles. "So you're here to kill Victor?" she asks. "He's not in."
"I am here to kill Victor, yes," says the Viking, "but also to kill you."
"Oh," says Joyce.
"They didn't tell you?"
"They didn't," confirms Joyce. "This seems like an awful lot of fuss. I hope it's over something very important."
"It's business," says the Viking. "I told Elizabeth to kill Victor. She didn't kill him. I told her I would kill you if she didn't."
"Well, she kept that quiet," says Joyce. "Have you ever killed anyone before?"
"Yes," says the Viking. His voice doesn't even waver. He's very impressed with himself.
"And yet you had to get Elizabeth to kill Victor for you," says Joyce. "Have you really ever killed anyone?"
"No," admits the Viking. "How could she tell?" "I have never needed to, but now I need to, and I will."
"So you're going to start with me?" "That's in at the deep end, I'd say. A pensioner."
The Viking shrugs. "Maybe I'll just kill Victor then."
"I'd sooner you didn't kill either of us," says Joyce. "I've grown fond of him. Watches too many programs about trains, but who doesn't have faults? What's your disagreement with him? Are you sure you don't want a cup of tea? We'll be here some while if we're waiting for Victor, and I promise I'm not going to poison you. The last thing I need on my hands is an unconscious Swede."
The Viking thinks he wouldn't actually mind a cup of tea. His whole plan doesn't seem at all right now. He's here with a gun in his hand and a tiny old woman asking him polite questions.
"Okay. Yes, please, just with milk. I have a dispute with Victor."
Joyce walks through the open archway into the kitchen and talks to him over her shoulder.
"What sort of dispute?"
"I loaned the money," says the Viking. "Through cryptocurrency, Victor tells his clients to steer clear of me. Says it's too risky. It is costing me a great deal of money. If I kill him, my problem is over."
"Oh, you poor love. That must be difficult," says Joyce. "Alan, I have literally just fed you."
"When are you expecting him?"
"You tell me," says Joyce, teaspoon clinking in a mug. "He's at an opera, if you can believe that. Might as well settle in. Can I ask you a question?"
"You won't persuade me not to kill him," says the Viking. "It is my destiny."
"No, no," says Joyce, walking back into the room with two mugs of tea, one with a picture of a motorbike on it, one with a floral scene. "Which mug do you fancy?"
"Motorbike, please," says the Viking.
Joyce sits down with a satisfied sigh.
"What's your question?" "Cryptocurrency," says Joyce. "It's not really all that risky, is it?
Very risky, says the Viking, which is okay for money laundering.
Even Ethereum, asks Joyce, is that risky?
The Viking takes a sip of his tea. You know Ethereum?
I have £15,000 invested in it, says Joyce. Everyone on Instagram seems very confident.
Can you show me your account? Says the Viking.
Honestly, amateurs will be the death of him. Cryptocurrency is complicated. One day it will be very important, but today it is the Wild West. Tiny old women should not be investing in Ethereum. Joyce opens up a page on her laptop and hands it to him.
I only use the laptop for trading and for writing my diary, she says. You'll be in it tonight, if you don't kill me.
I'm not going to kill you, says the Viking, but he knows he still might have to. He checks Joyce's Ethereum account, currently worth just under £2,000. Do you mind if I move things around a little? I will need your password.
It's Poppy, 82, capital P, says Joyce. And be my guest. If you promise not to kill Victor, then there are biscuits too.
Sorry. Mind made up, said the Viking as he drinks more of his tea and launches Joyce's laptop into one of the more disreputable corners of the dark web. Playing on the computer relaxes him a little, as this is where he is at home. His heart rate slows and he realizes how nervous he has been. The dog starts to lick his hand. He gently pushes Alan away and rubs his eyes with his unlicked hand. The Viking moves Joyce's money into two separate accounts. There are still bargains to be had if you knew where to look. There was still gold glinting in the streams, but not where everyone else was panning. The Viking feels this is the least he can do after breaking into Joyce's flat. If he doesn't kill her, she will make a tidy profit. Joyce is saying something now, but it isn't making sense. He is thirsty again. He looks up at Joyce, but his head is heavy. He starts a sentence. Could I get a...
Get a what? What's the word? Oh.
Alan is licking his face now.
Why is he on the floor?
Chapter 60. Ron is aware that we live in a bright new world of sexual politics, a rainbow of gender and sexuality and freedoms unimagined by his generation. Ron is all for it. If you let people be themselves, you let them flourish. But even in these happier times, if you offer a man a choice between a motorcycle mug and a flower mug, he's going to choose a motorcycle mug. Lucky thing, too, if Victor's tablets could floor the Viking, God knows what they would have done to Joyce.
You could have killed him, Joyce, says Elizabeth.
With sleeping pills and worming tablets, I doubt it, says Joyce. The Viking is beginning to stir. Bogdan has tied him to one of Joyce's dining room chairs. After he had fallen asleep, Joyce had called the cavalry, and here they all were. Bogdan from Muscle, Victor back from the opera, exquisite, almost transcendent, to face the man who wants to kill him, and Elizabeth, who has just had to explain why she hadn't told Joyce that the Viking was planning to kill her too. Ron and Ibrahim are there, presumably, thinks Ron, because Joyce and Elizabeth would never hear the end of it if they hadn't been invited. Pauline is there because, well, because... she is there an awful lot these days. Whether in Cooper's Chase or Juniper Court, she and Ron like to be together. She's come straight from work. Bogdan has disappeared somewhere for now. Victor is holding the Viking's gun. Ron had asked to hold it briefly. He had pointed it at the wall, closed one eye, said, "Pow!" and handed it back. The Viking looks a bit of a mess. Huge beard, semi-conscious. Ron had tried to grow a beard many years ago, but he was not successful. Some men just can't grow beards, and you shouldn't read anything into that. Doesn't make them any less of a man. Joyce has made them all a cup of tea after thoroughly washing out the motorbike mug.
"Hey, sleeping beauty," says Victor,
as the Viking wakes.
Hey!
The Viking opens his eyes just a touch, then closes them again, unable to immediately accept what he sees.
It's okay, says Victor. You can open them. You want some water?
The Viking opens his eyes once again and tries to focus on Joyce's carpet. With effort, he raises his head and looks towards Joyce.
You drugged me.
I did, admits Joyce.
You said you wouldn't, says the Viking.
Forgive me, says Joyce. You were going to kill Victor, and you were very imposing.
That is a fine beard, says Ibrahim. How do you go about growing a beard such as that? Do you use oils?
Maybe a question for another time, Ibrahim, says Victor.
Anyone can grow a beard, says Ron.
Victor gets down on his haunches. Ron remembers a time when he could get down on his haunches. Victor has been lucky with his knees.
What's your name, Viking?
No one shall ever know my name, says the Viking.
Well, we'll see about that, says Victor.
No one shall ever speak my name, says the Viking, and lets out a roar.
Well, someone's woken up, says Joyce. Alan wanders in from the bedroom to investigate the noise. Ron gives Pauline a reassuring wink. She is sitting forward, enjoying the theatre.
Best date ever, Ron, she says. Let's talk about why you want to kill me so much, says Victor, okay?
You will regret this, says the Viking. Every one of you will regret this.
I cost you money, I understand that, says Victor. I refuse to recommend you. But you understand why. Cryptocurrency is risky.
No, it isn't, says Joyce. Someone's been reading the mainstream media. She ruffles Alan's hair.
Haven't they, Alan?
Yes, they have.
You're living in the past, says the Viking.
There's a truth in that, says Victor. I live where I am comfortable. I live where my skills are. You will be the same in 30-40 years, talking about cryptocurrency while the youngsters laugh at you. But you know what is good for you here. I live in the past because I am old. I am old, my Viking friend. And you know what that means? It means you don't have to kill me. You just have to be patient. The cells in my body, they atrophy. As we speak, everyone you see before you will be dead before you know it.
Keep it light, Victor, says Pauline.
So, I'm a fool. So I'm in your way. I cost you some money, Victor shrugs. You're doing okay. I heard about your house. Just go about your business. You do it well. I know. You know why no one has killed me yet?
Why?
Because I never kill anyone, says Victor. Honestly, once you start, that's it. You have to keep killing.
That's like lip salve, says Pauline. Once you start using it, your lips dry out, so you have to keep using it.
Victor gestures towards Pauline to show his point is proven.
So, here is my suggestion. You get on with your life, launder money, enjoy your house, don't kill people. I'll get on with my life, do my job, then die of natural causes in 5 to 7 years if you're lucky.
And if I disagree, if I still think you cost me too much money,
then kill me, says Victor. I'll put the word out today to my many friends and associates that you wish to kill me, and when my body is found, they will come to their own conclusions and they will track you down and murder you.
A key turns in Joyce's door. Victor throws himself on the ground, pointing his gun towards it. As it opens, Bogdan walks in, and Victor reholsters the gun. Walking behind Bogdan is Stephen, looking very dapper in a suit. The Viking is focusing on Victor, however.
Your friends won't find me, says the Viking.
No one knows me. Look at you, a KGB colonel. And you have found out nothing about me. And you,
He turns to Elizabeth. An MI6 officer? You have found out nothing about me. I am a ghost. You can't kill a ghost. As the Viking makes his speech, Ron sees Stephen take a seat on one of Joyce's dining chairs. He pulls a notepad out of his pocket. Ron sees that Stephen's hands are shaking, but not from fear.
Ghost, are you, Chief?
Says Stephen, tapping his notebook. He has the immediate attention of the room.
Nice to see you again, by the way.
This is the Viking you were talking about then, Elizabeth.
Yes, dear, says Elizabeth, the very one.
Henrik Mikael Hansen, born in Norrköping on the 4th of May, 1989.
Stephen reads from his notebook. Mum, a pastry chef, dad, a librarian. What do you say to that?
You are wrong, says Henrik Mikael Hansen of Norrköping. You couldn't be more wrong. I'm Swedish, but apart from that, no one is a pastry chef.
You love books, Henrik, says Stephen. I love them too. You have quite the collection. A lot of them unique. And with unique books, you can usually find a record of their sale. Nowadays, you buy them all through a holding company, but when you first started collecting, you used your own name, and that's how we discovered your identity. It was a first edition of Wind in the Willows that gave you away.
No, says Henrik, this is impossible.
Far from it, Henrik. It is an admirable way to get caught, at least. Once we had the name, everything else fell into our laps. Your sister is currently skiing, for example, says Stephen. That's from Facebook.
Stephen, says Elizabeth.
Stephen.
Just doing my bit, says Stephen. Mainly Kuldesh. We owe them dinner.
You've really been to see Kuldesh?
I told you I had, said Stephen.
Yes, I, says Elizabeth.
We drove down, says Bogdan. Was a secret. Elizabeth fixes Bogdan with a stare.
Full of little secrets at the moment, aren't you, Bogdan?
Everyone else has turned to look at Henrik Hansen. Ron is glad he was invited to witness this whole scene. Previously, it's the sort of thing Elizabeth and Joyce would have taken care of themselves, only to fill him in the next morning. He is aware he hasn't yet been helpful, but he is grateful to be in the room.
I am not Henrik Hansen, says Henrik Hansen.
I think you probably are, says Elizabeth. My husband doesn't get an awful lot wrong.
Henrik, we can be friends, says Victor, or, if not friends, then acquaintances who choose not to kill each other. If you leave me in peace, I will make sure my many clients leave you in peace, too.
No, I am not Henrik, says Henrik, again his anger rising. You are all wrong, and you are all dead, every single one of you.
Henrik, says Joyce kindly, you couldn't even kill me.
Then I won't kill all of you, I will kill one of you, says Henrik.
Yes, as a lesson for the others, the second you let me go, the hunt begins.
Henrik's eyes scan the room looking for prey. They settle on Ron.
You, says Henrik, I will kill you.
Ron rolls his eyes.
It's always me.
You will never see me coming, says Henrik.
Pauling stands, slowly and calmly. She walks over to Henrik and places a hand on either side of his face. The room falls silent.
Henrik, listen to me carefully, my darling. I've met 1,000 men like you, and I know you need things spelled out for you, so here goes. If you even dream of touching a hair on Ron's head, I will kill you. That man is under my protection, and if any harm comes to him, I will put bullets in your knees, and then in your elbows, and then when I've tired of hearing you screaming, which will take a long, long time, I will put a bullet in your head to finish you off. In fact, if Ron wakes up with so much as a cough, I will find you, and I will cut out your heart and eat it, and I will send the video evidence to your mum, the pastry chef. Do we have the beginnings of an understanding?
Henrik is losing heart quickly. He points at Ibrahim now.
Then I will kill him.
Pauline squeezes his face even tighter. That's Ron's best friend, which makes him my best friend too. Ron has not seen Ibrahim blush before.
No one dies here today, continues Pauline. Victor has been very reasonable, so stop pretending to be a psychopath.
I am a psychopath, protests Henrik.
Darling, says Pauline, letting go of Henrik's face, a psychopath would have shot Alan. Alan gives a happy woof. He likes hearing his name.
Henrik looks beaten. I thought this would be easier.
I'm going to get you a water, says Joyce. It will be quite safe, I promise you.
Thank you, Joyce, says Henrik. I should have chosen the flower mug. Even as I chose the motorbike mug, I thought, oh, come on, that's so cliched.
We're all programmed, says Joyce. Joanna made me watch a YouTube video about it.
I'm going to untie you now, says Victor. I can trust you, yes? Even if I can't, I have a gun, and I'm assuming Elizabeth has a gun too, perhaps even Pauline has one.
Victor loosens the baling wire around Henrik's wrists, and he wriggles his hands free. Joyce comes back in with water, and Henrik takes it from her.
Thank you, Joyce, he says.
I can take a sip if you like, says Joyce.
The room falls into momentary, contented silence. It is broken by Pauline again.
Can I make an observation?
Ron looks at Pauline, who once again has the attention of the room. My God, he's got a hell of a woman on his hands here.
I love an observation, says Ibrahim. It is grist to my mill, especially coming from a good friend such as you, Pauline.
Okay. Here's how I see things, says Pauline, and I've only known you a short while, but this is just my take, and who am I to say? But each and every one of you in the room, each and every one of you in your own different way, is absolutely barking mad.
Joyce looks at Elizabeth. Elizabeth looks at Ibrahim. Ibrahim looks at Ron. Ron looks at Joyce. Victor and Alan look at each other. Stephen surveys the room.
She has a point.
I've known you for just over 2 weeks, and I've already been in a grave with a KGB colonel. I've seen a tiny old woman drug a Viking, and I've shared a bed with the most handsome man in Kent. For 3 or 4 years in the 80s, I did a lot of magic mushrooms. I once did LSD in Bratislava with Iron Maiden. But nothing, nothing I've ever done compares to a couple of days in your company. What else have you got in store?
Well, says Elizabeth, tomorrow we're digging up a garden with the Chief Constable of Kent, looking for a body and a gun.
Bethany's body? Says Pauline. She is suddenly serious.
Bethany's body, confirms Elizabeth. Now, Henrik, I wonder if you might stick around here for a day or so. There's a spare room at Ibrahim's, if Ibrahim wouldn't mind.
It would be my pleasure, says Ibrahim.
Henrik has had a long and traumatic day.
I just want to go home, says Henrik.
All in good time, Henrik, says Elizabeth. There's a task I think you might be able to help us with first.
Chapter 61. Joyce. Inspector Jerry Meadowcroft lit a cigarette and inhaled deeply. A cloud of smoke drifted across his fierce blue eyes, eyes that had seen too much killing, too much blood, too many widows. He felt the weight of a gun in his pocket. Would he have to use it? Jerry could kill. He had killed before, and he would kill again, if he was called upon. But not through choice, never through choice. Each time he killed, Jerry Meadowcroft lost a piece of his soul. How many pieces did he have left? Jerry was in no mood to find out. He thought back to his training at Ashford Police College. Not everyone trained at Hendon. That was a misconception. What do you think? I've been inspired to give writing a go. There is a short story competition in the Evening Argos. First prize, £100, and a Zoom call with a literary agent. I don't really want to do any more Zoom calls than I absolutely have to, but I could give the £100 to Alan's Rescue Centre, and it might be fun, mightn't it? My detective is named after Jerry, though my Jerry had brown eyes, because you have to change some things. Also, my Jerry had hay fever, and I've changed that too. I can't just have my Jerry pottering around solving a murder, so this Jerry has blue eyes and a gun, while my Jerry had brown eyes and an organ donor card. But my Jerry often said, "Well then, Bob's your uncle," and I'm going to make that the detective's catchphrase too. At the moment, the story is called Cannibal Bloodbath, but I might change that because it gives away too much of the plot. Chapter 62. So, they think they know where Bethany might be buried. Buried. That just makes no sense at all. Oh, Bethany. What on earth did you get involved in? Mike Waghorn pours himself a glass of cider. He doesn't really drink cider in public. It doesn't look right. In public, he drinks champagne, good wine, the sort of stuff people would expect Mike Waghorn to drink. A beer, if he's fitting in with the lads, at a corporate do. But when Mike was a teenager, he would only drink cider, and as he gets older, he finds himself returning to it. He has tried expensive cider. You can get that now. Waitrose does one, but really, the cheaper the better with the cider. The one he is currently drinking is from a 2-litre plastic bottle. He has poured it into a heavy-cut glass decanter just for appearances. But he might stop doing that soon as well. Who is he trying to fool? There is no one here, so he can only be fooling himself. He washes down his arthritis pills, then his beta blockers and his gout medication. You're not really supposed to drink alcohol with any of them, but no one is going to stop him. He is watching Stop the Clock on a very big television. Fiona Clements looks wonderful. He thought he should probably give it a go after Joyce mentioned it. Admit some professional jealousy, swallow a bit of pride. He has plenty to spare and watch it once. See if Fiona Clements is any good. He hoped not. Annoyingly, he watched an episode and is now hooked. Fiona is okay, friendly enough. Good at reading out loud. But what a quiz! Mike imagines what he might have done with it. Every time a contestant says something, Mike thinks about how he would respond. Once or twice, Fiona Clemens says the same thing as he would have done, and that irks him a little, but overall, he thinks he'd be slightly better. But isn't that just the thing, Mike? You can think all you like, but you never did it, never took the risks. He filmed a pilot once, the late 80s or so. It went well. Everybody agreed. ITV loved it, commissioned a series, but wanted one little change. Could they get a different host, someone younger, someone... And these words remained etched in his mind for a long time. More authentic. More real. Mike never put his perfectly groomed head above the parapet again, never left the burrow, however much he could smell the air outside. More authentic. More real. For years he had railed against this insult. Mike was real. Mike was authentic. And if some 20-somethings from London with fashionable hair and trainers couldn't see that, the problem was not with Mike. It was with them. So, there he sat behind his desk, year in, year out, telling the people of Kent and Sussex about fires in care homes, building society robberies in Faversham, or a Hastings man claiming to have the world's largest bouncy castle. And he was real enough and authentic enough for the people of Kent and Sussex, thank you very much. Walk through the streets of Maidstone or East Grinstead and see who thinks Mike is real. Everyone! There were a couple more approaches from national TV. Never anything concrete or exciting, but approaches nonetheless. But Mike refused even to consider them. He was happy where he was, thank you. Except Mike thinks back, looking at his cider in the ridiculous decanter. He wasn't happy at all. Did he know he wasn't happy? No. He had enough booze and enough local adulation to keep him sedated, to keep his train on the tracks. He'd started to become a little more irritable, sure, and a little bit more demanding of those he worked with, probably less fun to be around. But that, to his mind, was just professionalism. In a world where the people around him started getting younger and younger, as the teams he was used to working with started drifting off to bigger things, to London or, in one particularly galling case, to Los Angeles. But Mike was not happy. And the reason that Mike was not happy was that Mike was not authentic, and Mike was not real.